is going on, everyone? This is the Mushroom Revival Podcast. Thank you for shrooming in and tuning in for another episode. I'm your host, Alex Dorr, and I love to dive in and get into the mystical, wonderful world of fungi and mushrooms, bring on guests from all around the world to geek out with us and have a wonderful time. So we have Haya to talk about psychedelics in the Middle East. And Haya, how you doing?
Hey, Alex, how are you? Thanks for having me on. I'm really excited to be here.
I'm super excited to talk to you, not only about psychedelics, but also music and a million other topics as well. So who are you? What are you doing? Introduce yourself to all the listeners around the world.
Hey, so my name is Haya Al-Hijilan. I'm a psychedelic integration specialist. I'm a well-being practitioner, a positive psychologist, and a musician. I live in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. That's where I call home. And my journey with psychedelics has taken me all over the world. It started when I was an undergraduate at Claremont McKenna College in California. So coming up on 10 years, actually. And I'd be happy to chat some more about that too, as we converse today.
I'm guessing California is where you got introduced to psychedelics.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it's a very psychedelic place, mostly. Were you offered some in school, or like what was your first introduction to psychedelics?
So my first introduction was through a lecture titled "The Psychedelic Renaissance" that James Vandeman was giving at my university or at my college. And prior to that, I was very much educated by the war on drugs propaganda. So to me, all drugs were bad. And psychedelics were also drugs. There was a part of me, this is my sophomore year of college. So a part of me was really curious because I saw that all these really intelligent kids around me in my school were experimenting with drugs. And I thought to myself, I was told that drugs are bad and everyone who takes drugs is going to end up under a bridge or in a really bad situation. Why is it that these really smart kids are experimenting with it, and how come they're still doing pretty well? So I started looking. I just started looking into drugs generally. Just doing some nerding out, researching. I have ADHD, so I tend to get hyper fixated or hyper focused on a topic.
Same.
And yeah, it's both a superpower and a disadvantage at times. But yeah, I mean, my interest in drugs started when I was actually 12 years old, because around that time there were people around me who were using drugs, but they weren't using it in a very healthy way. And I mean, it really further served the war on drug propaganda that I was being educated with. So my interest back then was just what are drugs in general? And I would read into it. But then for many years after that, I didn't really think about the topic. I just thought that was something that I needed to avoid completely. Around my sophomore year of college, that's when I started. My freshman year of college is when I actually first started acknowledging mental health as something that was important and something that existed. And that took me to the offices of clinical psychologists and psychiatrists to kind of figure out what was going on with me at the time. And I was prescribed a number of pharmaceuticals, and none of them really worked. So I was really frustrated with that aspect of the mental health complex, let's say, or the field in general. So I started hearing about psychedelics, and for some reason the image that kept coming up in my head was Mario, Super Mario, and that mushroom. So why is it that when he eats that mushroom, he becomes big and he becomes all powerful? So I started kind of looking into that. I was listening to a lot of psychedelic music at the time, like Alt J, and it was We're going to talk about music some more later, but that was, I mean, that was an introduction to me, for me, into altered states of consciousness through music. When Fadiman came to give that lecture, I was completely flabbergasted. I was completely, like, my jaw had dropped to the floor because I didn't know that there was an entire history and there was so much science behind psychedelics and that there was so much potential for psychedelics to actually heal. And as I mentioned, I was completely disappointed and distrustful of the pharmaceutical industry. So to me, hearing that there was something natural or something more natural, more sustainable, that actually really helped you get to the core root of your ailments or your illnesses, as opposed to just slapping a Band-Aid and treating the symptoms. To me, that was really interesting. And coincidentally, at that time, I was switching majors from government and international relations to psychology. And it just so happened that this was very much this was aligned with the trajectory that I wanted my life to take at the time, which is I wanted to become a therapist at the time. Things have changed since, but yeah. And to me at the time, I also thought to myself, like, there's no way I'm going to be sitting in an office with a client or with a patient and look, there's no way I can look at them and tell them, hey, I know that there's something out there that could really, really help you, but I can't offer it to you, or I can't guide you to it because it's illegal because of completely unscientific reasons. So, and because of, you know, 99.9% because of dogmatic reasons. So yeah, so I decided back then that I was going to dedicate my life and my career to fight, which is to make psychedelic medicine and psychedelic science and psychedelic therapies accessible and available to all those who need it. Yeah.
What deterred you from wanting to become a therapist?
I think I'm at a place in my life where, I mean, a few years back, I think I would have made a fantastic therapist. When I was in college, my room, I had this nice couch that people would just come and sit on and would just chat and chat and chat. I think I'm just going through a period in my life where I want to be a bit more detached for my own sake and for the sake of those I work with. What I mean to say is that, I mean, a few years back, I think I was overly empathetic, and that was to my detriment. I think I burnt out, to be very honest with you. There's something called empathy burnout. But what I'm learning, what I'm learning is that compassion is, empathy is not the way to go if you want to be sustainable. It's compassion. It's being able to be with someone, but from where you sit, not trying to, not disadvantaging both yourself and disempowering them by experiencing their emotions for themselves. So I think that at the point where I'm at right now in life, I think I probably would be, I'm better off doing something that's a bit more macro rather than micro, meaning getting involved with organizing policy, advising on policy and things of that sort. And maybe in the future, once I've had some more life experience and I'm in a different place in my life, I will entertain the thought of becoming a therapist again.
It's funny. I'm kind of in the same boat where it's always been on the horizon for me, and it seems like something in the way future, but I have the same sentiments about it of I'm terrified of having empathy burnout because mm-hmm. I feel like I have a strength of being able to go to really deep places with people and like hold space and be really empathetic. But after a while I do get burnt out and I really admire, I have tons of therapist friends, and they're able to take on many clients a day and talk about, you know, really, really deep and traumatic things, and able to, you know, have skip at the end of the day and, you know, have a smile on their face and like do live their life, you know, and travel all the time and do all this stuff. And talking with them and how they do it and just like their techniques of how they can be open but also have boundaries. And that perfect balance of just holding a really solid space I am really interested in learning how to do that. Mm-hmm. And especially with psychedelic medicine as well, it's like traditional talk therapy is enough, but if the therapists themselves are microdosing while the patient is macrodosing, mm-hmm. I mean, like, that's a whole nother level of keeping your boundaries. And, you know, I feel like you're able to go to a much deeper place, but at the same time, how do you protect yourself from empathy burnout? I'm really fascinated by that. I think maybe in 5 or 10 years that'll be my path. But mm-hmm. but in the meantime, for you, what has it been like in Saudi Arabia with drug policy and even just talking about it? You know, you're talking about your childhood with the war on drugs being pretty much the only conversation around. But mm-hmm. I listened to another interview with you, and you said pretty much over time it's gotten a lot better and people are more welcoming about it. What has been your experience with the whole kind of energy towards psychedelics in Saudi Arabia?
Mm-hmm. So people are very receptive, much to my surprise. And this has just become the case in the last 3 years, I want to say. Prior to that, it was a very difficult conversation. And I knew that this was becoming more accepted here when three things had happened. The first was that I went to a conference in Kuwait that was put on by the Middle East Psychological Association, or MIPA. And I was speaking very openly about my area of interest, or my area of the area that I'm focusing on, which is psychedelic science. And I was met mostly with mostly in a positive with a positive attitude. Most of who I spoke to, clinical psychologists, psychotherapists, were very open to having this conversation with me. And the conversation would go like, "Oh, I've heard about ayahuasca, or I heard about this thing or that thing, and it sounds really promising." And I only had one person that trip really say something negative. And later at that conference, there was a lecture or a keynote speaker who spoke about the future of mental health care. His name is Dr. Mohammed Swaydan. He's a very well-known psychiatrist in the country of Kuwait. It's a small nation that's very close to Saudi Arabia. So his presentation was on the future of mental health care. And he prefaced a few slides saying that this is a new area of research, or it's an area of research that has been revived. And it's an area of research that I personally am very, very supportive of. And he presses the clicker, and there's on the screen, it says ketamine-assisted therapy. And I'm just over the moon. I was so excited. And I was like, this is the first time I hear someone speaking about psychedelics openly in the Middle East. And he clicks some more slides on ketamine-assisted therapy, clicks again, and there's a slide on psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy.
Wow.
And that was major for me. Even the person who had made that negative remark was in the room when this presentation was happening. And I remember turning back to them and saying, "Look, you see, this is science. This is actual, like, this is the future of mental health care in many ways." So that was one of the first incidences. The second one was that I worked for a startup at the time. This was 3 years ago, before I left for my master's. The startup was like a positive psychology coaching startup. And I came across documents that I'm not really at liberty to discuss too openly because of confidentiality and things of that sort. But the documents suggested that people high up in governmental positions were aware of what psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy and MDMA-assisted therapy were. So that was also big. That was a big victory for me. And then there was a third incident that happened, which was that I went to a bookstore here. This is Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, 2019. And I see on the shelf of bestsellers, Michael Pollan's How to Change Your Mind. There's books on psychedelics that are being sold at a major bookstore in Saudi Arabia. So that was really, I mean, these three events were really what changed everything for me. And so much has happened since. I think I got lost in the excitement. So just to make sure I'm on track. So to respond to your question on how is the energy around psychedelics here, very hopeful, very positive, slow though. I have to say it's really slow. In January of 2022, there was an article that came out in a major news outlet here in Saudi Arabia. It's called the Sharq al-Awsat, or the translation is Middle East, I guess that's the translation. I don't know what it's called in. It's actually called Sharq al-Awsat in English. So it's a huge news outlet here, and the article was titled "Magic Mushrooms for the Treatment of Mental Illnesses," and I was in Arabic, and it's really funny what they called magic mushrooms in Arabic, al-fatr al-sahri, which in Arabic sounds really funny. it's like magical fungi or something like that. So there were major news outlets writing about magic mushrooms in Arabic. The discourse was happening in that language, which was really, I mean, this is a language that's spoken by about 40 million people around the world. I'm probably underestimating the numbers. So it's really, it was really promising to see that this conversation was happening. 6 months after that news article came out, I did an interview, or 5 months, I did an interview with another major news outlet called Arab News, in which I spoke about the future of psychedelic treatment in Saudi Arabia. And it was received very, very positively. The fact that I was able to talk about it openly, that was a major victory for the psychedelic for the field of psychedelic science. Yeah. So, and that really circulated and made its way around. And I was getting a lot of messages from people who were asking me, how can we get involved? That was really exciting, seeing that there was so much energy that people were willing to give to the cause, let's say. And then there were some heartbreaking messages of people telling me, you know, detailing to me their journey with mental health, and how they're really looking at psychedelic therapy as either as a last resort or as their last hope. So, and these are people who I had to really, you know, I had to tell them that it's not available currently, but it will be available soon. So just hold on to that hope. There is actually ketamine-assisted therapy, or ketamine therapy is administered in the Middle East. There is a clinic in Kuwait, Dr. Mohammed Suedan, the same person that I mentioned, the psychiatrist, and at a clinic, at a major clinic here, Habib Hospital, they apparently offer ketamine therapy. But someone was telling me, I was talking to someone at a party, and they were telling me basically that they were thinking of doing ketamine therapy, but it was going to cost them around 60,000 riyals, which is something, it's, I think, close to like $15,000. So it's not very accessible. Jeez. So that individual opted for electric shock therapy, which is unfortunate because psychedelics are probably more effective and less damaging.
Yeah. And I know in the last, 23 years? I think it was 1999 that women in Saudi Arabia could get national IDs. And then it wasn't, I think, 5 years ago when women can drive in Saudi Arabia. So as a woman talking about psychedelic drugs, which are very illegal, and most of the time it's 2 to 10 years in prison with lashings or whippings. And
oh, that doesn't potentially happen anymore.
The
whipping, okay, and the lashing. Yeah.
I heard many different things. Some websites were like, you're pretty much going to get the death penalty no matter what kind of drug. Other ones were a little more lenient.
Yeah.
But I guess it's been changing. But as a woman talking about these topics, like, do you Have you ever feared for your safety, or is it getting better over time, or do you feel pretty comfortable with talking about these things?
So the big difference is that I'm not talking about psychedelic drugs. I'm talking about psychedelic therapy and psychedelic science.
Okay.
So, was I scared or was I nervous? Absolutely. When I first started talking about psychedelics openly, which was 2018, 4 years ago, that's around the same time the women were given the right to drive. I was nervous, and I was told to be careful, and I was told I was going to go to jail. But I'm a very I'm very stubborn. I have a lot of conviction in what I believe is right or true, and I think that healing is a very basic human right. So I was willing to suffer whatever consequences, as long as that meant I get to live with integrity and I get to fight for what I think is right, what I believe is right. Since then, I left to the UK for my master's. I completed a master's of science in applied positive psychology and coaching psychology, also focusing on psychedelic science. So I have a lot more credibility and credentials when talking about psychedelics now than I did back then. Back then, what I had was a bachelor's degree in psychology and a senior thesis on the clinical applications of psychedelics. So I still was very confident with that. I'm a lot more confident today. I've been professionally involved in the field since 2018. So I have a lot more experience. I'm a lot more, careful. I'm less enthusiastic or I'm not as overzealous as I was when I first started, because I have the capacity to think in a more nuanced manner now that I've had more time and more experience in the field. So the way that I speak about this topic is very different today than it was 4 years ago. 4 years ago was a bit more hyped, let's say, whereas nowadays it's more... I'd like to think that I'm a lot more level-headed and a lot less biased when I speak about psychedelic science or psychedelic therapy.
And you recently started the Arab Psychedelic Society. Are you mainly focused on Saudi Arabia at this point, or pretty much all countries in the Arab world or in mm-hmm. the Middle East or, Swana region? Or are you seeing certain countries more along than others that you want to focus on first to kind of like open the door, so to speak, for the rest of the Arab world?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So, just to tie this back to the last question, before the interview that I did with Arab News, I was really, really worried about putting together an Arab Psychedelic Society, but that's been something that I've been thinking about for a very, very long time. So once the interview was published, that's when I took it as a green light to put together a psychedelic society. We might change it to an association, just because society raises more eyebrows than an association. So the Arab Psychedelic Society, reflected in the name, is open to all Arabs, and it doesn't just focus on Saudi. There's a bit of a spin-off of that I've created with some people here, which is the Saudi Psychedelic Network. But we've just had a few meetings, really. And we've worked on, together we worked on a presentation that a clinical pharmacist was going to present at a competition, a clinical pharmacy competition. Unfortunately, that was great for us to build a community and to collaborate, but unfortunately that presentation did not pass, but there's always next year, so we're optimistic. As for the Arab Psychedelic Society, it's open to everyone in the Middle East and North Africa, the MENA region, or what we nowadays call the Swana region, Southwest Asia and North Africa, or the Arab world. It's open to everyone. The goal is to have a platform where we can highlight the work that Arabs are doing in the field. There's a lot more of us than I was thinking, but we're just so spread out. There's, you know, someone in Florida, a chemist in Florida. There's a neuroscientist in Colorado. There are a bunch of people here in the Middle East too, a clinical psychologist based in Dubai, who was educated in the UK. So there's a lot of us doing, doing this kind of work, but we're spread around. There's also a psychiatrist, he's Egyptian, in the UK, also in Newcastle, if I'm not mistaken. But this is a platform where we can really highlight and celebrate Arabs that are doing this work. So I don't know if you've had a chance to look at the page, but there's a few posts about a few different individuals who are doing amazing work. This is just for people to be aware of, you know, what's going on in the region, in the space, and to connect, because we have to really, and the pun is fully intended here, but we really need to expand the mycelial network if we want to do anything that's going to be sustainable and that's going to be impactful. And we also have, we have a vision and a mission and goals, smaller goals, which I'm happy to discuss real quick. So the vision is to bridge the gap between Arab communities and psychedelic science by promoting psychedelic research in the Arab world and working towards establishing a psychedelic research center and clinic in the region. So my goal personally is to, my ultimate goal would be to establish a clinic and a research center here. I also would like to give a shout out to Sima Basile, who helped me put together this document. She's a wonderful clinical psychologist based in Dubai, and she's a mycologist. So I think it would be great to put her in touch also with the podcast. I think she would really
be an
awesome guest. Yeah. So, So our goal is to have that, so to have the clinic and a research center open somewhere. I personally think that Saudi Arabia is a very good candidate for that for numerous reasons, which I'm happy to expand on. But just to go back to what our mission is, we're a platform that hopes to encourage collaboration and to create more access by educating the public on what psychedelics are. So psychoeducation is a really big one. That's in Saudi and in the Middle East, I think we're really going to have to start with psychoeducation before we even think about research or clinics. So these are some of the points that we're hoping to accomplish, encourage research in the future, education before research. So to establish a mentorship program and connect experienced professionals, mentors to other professionals interested in the field, to mentees. That's something that's inspired by work that I do with SSPD, which is Students for Sensible Drug Policy. I'm currently a mentor with them, and I'm hoping to be able to expand that to the Middle East too. What are some of the other points we have here? So professional development. Also, we want to create an avenue, an official avenue to connect, collect donations and to apply for grants and research for research and professional training. I really hope me and my colleague Seema are really hoping that we can create scholarship programs to encourage individuals in the region to get more involved in the field. And really education is something that we're very much focused on, or we're trying to drill the point of education. Psychoeducation is really the foundation. And another point that we want to do that is based on education is we want to create more access or accessibility by translating research papers and educational documents from English to Arabic. So that's, in a nutshell, that's who we are. The journey ahead of us is going to be very long, but there's a quote that I heard Rick Doblin say in a podcast, and it really resonated with me. Even if You know, even if we don't accomplish these goals in our lifetime, at least on my deathbed, I'll know that, you know, I've dedicated my life to trying to accomplish it. But I'm quite optimistic that we will accomplish these goals.
And one of the ways that you excuse me are spreading that mycelium is through this group called the Psychedelic Renaissance, which is making a documentary. How is that project going?
So we actually got called out not long ago for using the term psychedelic renaissance. And it's interesting because our team is mostly, we're mostly people of color, people of more different, like of several marginalized identities. But I understand the point. So the person that called us out was saying that the psychedelic renaissance is a colonial term because it isn't a renaissance, and indigenous people have continued to use psychedelics despite the draconian laws that prevented or despite like the war on drugs and the many decades that every time I speak about it, I have such a strong emotional reaction thinking about how many decades of research we lost out on because of dogma, again, just because of dogma, not because of science. But despite the hiatus in psychedelic research or in psychedelic science, there still was a flourishing psychedelic world, let's say, in indigenous communities. So instead of psychedelic renaissance, we're calling our project the Psychedelic Chronicles. And I think actually it's more fitting as a title because the project, which is a film, it's a documentary, it started about 5 years ago. I joined 4 years ago, 1 year into the project. And it's a project that is very much in collaboration with the Psychedelic Society of the UK. Anya, my dear friend and my collaborator, my colleague, she is one of the directors of the Psychedelic Society, and she is basically the magic woman behind the project. She's the maestro, let's say, or the main person who is the brains and the brawn behind it. So we call it the Psychedelic Chronicles because we have had the, it's really frustrating that it's taking us so long to complete the project. We were hoping to premiere it in 2021, but COVID and a bunch of different things happened. But the advantage to having to prolong the process is that we've been able to capture pivotal moments in the revival of psychedelic science and psychedelic therapy and research. So yeah, we're chronicling the movement, or let's say the movement as it moves to the mainstream. And we also look at, we explore and very much respect the indigenous practices that have, that predated any type of scientific inquiry and that continued to, were resilient in the face of the war on drugs. So we explore that too. But a big thing that we really focus on is psychedelic science and the research into it. So yeah, and it's been, I've had the pleasure of meeting and working with some really amazing individuals in the field. We've done some work with Decriminalize Denver. We've gotten to speak with them, interview them in Colorado. We've had some amazing conversations that we've recorded with scientists at Imperial College London, and so on and so forth. Yeah.
I'm guessing your parents know what you're doing now.
Yeah, now they do.
Okay, yeah. I mean, is it a recent thing? Have you had to kind of hide it from them?
The day after James Fadiman's lecture this was October of 2013. I remember going to my dad and telling him, oh my God, this is amazing. Like, mushrooms are great. Mushrooms are the future. And my dad was like, hey, you need to calm down. Like, these are drugs. Yeah. And to be honest, I mean, at the time I was, you know, I was a 19-year-old. I was very naive. I had gone through an extreme, like, hippie phase two, I think I was trying to relive the late 60s in the 2010s. But yeah, so I don't think I did myself too much benefit by being a total hippie and talking about psychedelics. But that was part of my own professional and personal growth. But yeah, I mean, I will give myself credit, because regardless of how much of a hippie I was at the time, I still was a very brainy hippie and very nerdy. So I was taking all types of classes at the time, brain and behavior. I was doing field work in clinical psychology. I was taking all these other very scientific based courses, and I was writing papers on psychedelics. So I wasn't just walking barefoot around campus in my tie-dye shirt preaching about how amazing LSD and Timothy Leary were, and I mean LSD is and Timothy Leary was. I mean, I also, I'm just a lot more, my capacity to think is a lot more nuanced now than it was back then. And I understand that someone
same.
Yeah. Thank God for growth, right?
Yeah. No, I went through the same thing. So
yeah.
All part of the journey.
Part of the journey, absolutely. Yeah. And as my mycelial network grew, I was exposed to a lot of different opinions and ways of viewing the world that made me realize that, Timothy Leary wasn't the most enlightened person in the world. And, Maria Sabina actually contributed in many ways. And actually, Maria Sabina had a very tragic end to her life because of nuanced issues that we are starting to talk about these days, which is great. But also doesn't make up for the issues in the space that we need to proactively be tackling. And I talk about, when I say that, I mean, looking at certain things from a very Euro or Western centric lens, and not giving indigenous communities and history its due credit and due respect and things of that sort. There's a lot more that we can talk about. But before I'm just going to pour myself some water here. I'm recovering from a cold, so my throat is a bit dry and itchy. But yeah, so something else that I think is it's a lot more of a conversation that I have these days as opposed to where I was 4 years ago, is talking about the shadow side of psychedelics. And this is something that our documentary, The Psychedelic Chronicles, really focuses on.
And when you say shadow side, do you mean confronting your own shadow through psychedelics, or maybe some of the contraindications with people, maybe with schizophrenia, or combining it with certain prescription drugs that might have or maybe people taking too much, or how do you define the shadow side of psychedelics?
So the shadow side is definitely, I would say, a part of it is confronting your own shadow. But I think about it on a more, yes, on a micro level and on a macro level. Like, for example, psychedelic narcissism or spiritual narcissism, that's a shadow side. And that's something that I experienced in my early 20s and was part of the growth, right? I thought that I was this all-knowing, enlightened being, and I realized that I was just spiritually bypassing a lot of pain. Altered states of consciousness, let's say, because I want to plead the fifth here, but altered states of consciousness really helped me. They helped me to open the door to my healing. And I mean, the door was left ajar, but I also had to do a lot more work to continue opening that door and pushing it further. But I thought that I mistakenly thought that that little piece that was opened, or my metaphors here are really failing me. But yeah, I mean, that the little bit of light that was coming in through that crack of the door being opened, that was just, 1% of the healing journey, or maybe a bit more than that. But yeah, I had a very narrow view back then, because I mean, I was 19, 20, 21. My prefrontal cortex wasn't fully developed. So, I mean, yeah. Maturation happens over time and experience, and that's really what happened. But yeah, so I had my own, I mean, it's not something I'm very proud of to talk about, but honestly, I think it makes me a better rounded individual and practitioner. Talking about my own experiences with psychedelic narcissism and spiritual bypassing. So that's one of the, and psychedelics can be a bit culty, honestly, when I think back to some of the experiences I had.
1000%. Yeah.
So that's a dark side. That's a shadow side. That's definitely a shadow side. Also, there's an amazing, one of my idols in the space. And now as I say idol, I'm starting to think, oh, is that problematic? Should I not be idolizing people? But you know what I mean? My role model.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my role models, Dr. Rosalind Watts from she previously was with Imperial College London. And she's actually, we've worked with her quite extensively. Anya has sat down with her for many interviews for the Psychedelic Chronicles documentary. So she had a TED Talk from, I think I want to say it's from 2016, about, it was titled, Can Magic Mushrooms Cure Depression? And it was a phenomenal talk. But what I really respect about Dr. Watts is that she recently wrote an article looking back and reflecting on that talk that she gave in 2016 and what she and the field has learned since. And she spoke about how, she spoke about how she was mistaken at the time to have maybe overly hyped about the promise of psychedelics. And since, and this is something that I have experienced myself, since she has given that talk in 2016, she's had a lot more experiences where she saw how psychedelics can really, things can really go wrong with psychedelic therapy and yeah. psychedelic in research. And it's just, it doesn't mean that, I mean, it's not, we shouldn't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Is that the expression?
Yeah,
I'm forgetting.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I hope
there's
I'm using
so many
it correctly
weird,
here.
There's so many weird phrases in English, like raining cats and dogs. And that's a whole other rabbit hole that I don't want to get into. But yeah, keep going.
Cats and dogs, rabbit holes. Yeah. But that's
rabbit
really,
hole, yeah.
That's funny. But I'm a big fan of the English language. But I like these expressions. But anyways, I'll try not to digress too much as I tend to do. But yeah, so Rosalind was, the point that she was getting to is that, I mean, there's still so much promise in the field of psychedelic science, but there's so much more that we don't know than there is that we know. And of course, right. What we don't know that we don't know, that's a whole other world too. But I think we're starting to become a lot more humble and a lot more aware of how much we don't know and how much time it's going to take for us to really, to uncover the many depths of psychedelic science. And it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of trial and error, unfortunately. But that's how it is with science, right? For us to really understand how to optimally use psychedelics in our goal to heal as many people as possible, and you know what the caveats are, what the dangers or the risks are, and how to properly mitigate these risks. So there's so much more to learn, but it's a great time to be alive right now in the field. It's probably the most exciting time since the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, no, it is a really interesting topic that I've been actually trying to grapple with for the last 2-3 years, and I don't have an answer. I don't know if I ever will. Maybe I will, but I'm becoming okay with not ever having an answer. But mm-hmm. It's this idea of trying to juggle and balance between wanting people to be starry-eyed, and you want to spread the message about whether it's psychedelics or mushrooms or whatever it is. And you want to pump people up with these, you know, like, they're going to save the world, they're going to, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you want to tell these stories that are sexy and they're enticing. Yeah. And they make people feel really good. Mm-hmm. But are they entirely true? No.
Yeah.
Right? And like, they're not entirely true, and that's not really reality. And so people go through this cycle, kind of what we're talking about, of people being starry-eyed and like kind of like this spiritual narcissism, and they just kind of spiritually bypass the truth for something that feels better.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like I used to study micro-remediation, which is the study of like how to clean up toxic waste in the environment with mushrooms and fungi. Most of that, and most people talking about it, is complete bullshit. And like, it's just complete like bypassing of like the nitty gritty truth of how do you actually do it. And instead it's like, yeah, you just throw mycelium on it and it magically cleans it up. And it's like snap of the fingers, which most people are doing with psychedelics as well, is like, yeah, just eat a bunch of mushrooms and you'll be fine. And it's like, nah, you know, like, not exactly true. So I don't know if you have any insight on this, of how do you balance between staying really grounded and true to science and true to that shadow, while also trying to be enticing and sexy and, you know, like trying to get people really excited for kind of the people that don't know much about psychedelics.
Yeah, so I mean, I think one of the reasons why, so there's two issues in the space, right? There was the demonization of psychedelics, which is a result of the war on drugs and the unfortunate series of events that happened in the late 60s and things of that sort. So there's the demonization and the vilification of psychedelics. But then on the other hand, there's also the glorifying of psychedelics, which is what we're talking about right now. So how do we make sure that we bust myths while not creating more myths, in a sense, right? So, I mean, I think it's really important, very difficult, but also very, very important to be as biased, I mean, as unbiased as possible. And to try to, I have a problem with saying this, but I'm going to say it, to be as scientific as possible when educating people on psychedelics. The reason why I have an issue with it is because I think that sometimes being overly scientific can have colonial undertones, and also that can be very rigid. And I mean, I'm a very scientific person. I believe that there are things that science isn't, our science today isn't able to explain yet. But it's still scientific. It's just we haven't gotten into that language yet.
And most people have been brainwashed through the colonial framework, and the only way to communicate with them effectively for most people is through the scientific method. Unfortunately, it's just where most people are at. Most Joe Schmoes and people at home, if someone in a white lab coat is telling them with a peer-reviewed scientific paper, it's just more trustworthy. And that's just where we're at in this conversation at this stage in human evolution, unfortunately. But yeah, I hear what you're saying. I feel the same way.
I mean, in my context also, like thinking about like... I think I'm cutting. Can you hear me?
Yeah, you're good. Can you hear me?
Okay, great, great. It cut for a second, but we're fine now.
Okay. Going on to music, switching gears entirely. We were talking about Maria Sabina, and we were talking about kind of the indigenous wisdom that needs to be acknowledged. And I think one thing that Maria Sabina is really well known for are her medicine songs. And a lot of, you know, indigenous medicine people work with music and these medicine songs in collaboration and ceremony, and it helps to guide the space. And as a musician myself, I've always been fascinated. It kind of seems like the same thing, but a different tool, and how to get to an altered state, right? And I don't know if you are able to access altered states while playing music. I, for one, totally am. And I know a lot of musicians talk about it of like when they get into that flow state of when they're like improvising or playing something and they get into a flow, you know, mm-hmm. and they get into an altered state where it is very psychedelic. And I'm just curious, and for you, how do these two worlds collide?
Okay, I have a lot to say on this topic. I want to start with a news article that I came across 4 years ago. It was in Time magazine, and it was written by someone who later became my professor when I did my master's. So the article was on positive linguistic or terms that have a positive meaning that are unique to different languages. So, for example, the term that really caught my eye, and I've thought about getting it tattooed on my body. I don't have any tattoos, and I'm actually kind of glad that I didn't get a lot of the ideas I had tattooed. but if I were to get a tattoo, if I do end up getting a tattoo, it will be of the Arabic word tarab. So it's spelled T-A-R-A-B. And what it means, and there's no equivalent in the Western context of this word. So what tarab means, it's the state of ecstasy that one enters through music. So it's this altered state of consciousness that one finds through music. And I find that very beautiful. And that's something that I've experienced many, many times before. So music is very much, that's a great way to enter an altered state of consciousness. You spoke about flow state. You spoke about, also chanting and Icaros and things of that sort. So Mendel Kaelin, who is a very well-known researcher that does research into psychedelics and music, he has a quote that I really, really like and really resonated with me. So he said that he thought that his first experience with an altered state of consciousness was through psilocybin, but in actuality, it was through music. And this is the same researcher who wrote extensively on and did a lot of research on music in the context of psychedelic therapy. There's a paper, an amazing paper he has that's titled Music in Psychedelic Therapy, the Music as the Hidden Therapist, essentially. I don't know if I'm probably not getting the title of the study correct to the word, but that's what it says. It calls music the hidden therapist in the context of psychedelic therapy. So it's a very fascinating field subcategory of this field of psychedelic science. And when I had the privilege of sitting through parts A, B, and C of the MAPS MDMA assisted therapy training, thanks to Natalie Ginsberg, who's an amazing woman doing great work in this field. But when I sat through these trainings, there was quite a bit of talk on the importance of music. And in different settings also, I've heard some of the most esteemed researchers and practitioners in the field talk about how psychedelic or music in the context of psychedelic therapy is going to be an area that will be hugely studied and researched in the future. But we gotta wait for things to happen step by step. First, we're talking about decriminalization, medicalization, things of that sort, and then we'll get to that. That's something that also, as part of the Arab Psychedelic Society, I really hope to push people who are thinking about doing specializing in music therapy, like write a thesis on music therapy in the context of psychedelics in the Middle East or in the Arab culture and Arab cultures. Because, you know, for me as an Arab, if I were sitting in a ceremony, it's probably very different for me to be listening to something in my own language than to be listening to, something that's sung in, in a language that's native to the Amazon. Not to take away or diminish from how important that is, or how worthy of respect and appreciation that is too. But I'm just talking about in my own context. I probably would be more receptive to songs or chants in Arabic than I would be to something that's sung in another language. And I know I'm not alone in this. And I mean, I would really love to conduct research in that part, in that department. But I'm involved with quite a bit, so I really need to make sure I'm taking bites that are pizza bites, let's say, that are chewable and I can swallow. So yeah.
It's interesting as well, because I know the Persian scale is really popular around in the Arab world, and mm-hmm. in terms of music, the scale. And you know, in different countries they have different like quarter notes, you know. Mm-hmm. I haven't taken music theory in so many years, so I'm probably butchering the exact names for these things.
No, you got it right.
But also like
quarter
tones. Yeah, or like the even just like the style of beats, or just like the tone of the instruments, or even just the type of instruments used, you know what I mean? The feeling of, you know, I always thought it was fascinating, different countries, like if there was a lot of trauma or suffering in a place, you know, mm-hmm. you have more blues influence, or just like there's this undertone of, there's a deeper feeling of sadness, which can turn into something beautiful, you know, and mm-hmm. And different countries, like, for example, like Colombia is mm-hmm. a lot faster paced than like Peruvian music typically. And it's like, how do you turn your suffering into music? And it's either like slower or faster, let's party, you know?
Okay.
And like, and it's interesting, like, so how, you know, if you're from different regions, like how does that influence you on a soul level, you know? Yeah, I would love to see more research into music mm-hmm. and music therapy, especially in collaboration with psychedelics. When my grandma got Alzheimer's, and we were trying to play music for her from like her childhood, because mm-hmm. there was a lot of research that if you play older music, apparently part of the brain that remembers music is similar to the start of where Alzheimer's starts, you start to lose your memory. And so it's a technique that they use in like Alzheimer's homes to help people regain some of their memories. Mm-hmm. And so I think it'd be interesting as well to maybe like, yeah, I hear a lot in psychology of people like tuning out certain years of their life if they have, mm-hmm. you know, if they were maybe sexually abused when they were 7, you know, mm-hmm. to 9. And this age of 7 to 9, they just block out, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just a gap in their timeline. If you played music, you know, similar to that timeline, would that help like recover in a safe setting? Those memories to work through them like in a safe space.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Thank you for sharing that. It makes me think also, it makes me think about a video I saw not long ago, or a documentary about using music to help stroke patients or people who survive strokes regain motor skills and things of that sort. And it's amazing to see how they're really impaired in every aspect of their life, of their lives. But then you play a track, or you have them sit at a piano, and they're you know, as good as new in a sense. So it's really fascinating. There's a lot to be said. I mean, or there's a lot to be explored in that region too. Or it's really exciting.
Yeah, I just saw an article about I can't remember what national park, but they were noticing that bears would sit and just look out into nature. Like they would find a really scenic view mm-hmm. and like sit against a log and just look out into like a sunset or something, or like a beautiful lake, and okay. just like sit there and they were like, yeah, they're actually just enjoying the peace. Like there's no extra motive behind just enjoying the scenery. And I was just reading an article as well. They were saying how, you know, most birds, they have song for a reason, right? To say, hey, like a threat is coming, or, you know, a mating call or something. There's like, there's a reason beneath the song. And they're finding out that a lot of birds and whales and all these animals are actually like producing music and art just like us, just to, just for the beauty of it and just to produce it. Or at least that's our understanding. And it's, yeah, it's another part of, it's another thing that science can't touch of like, what is art? What is beauty? Why do we do the things that we do? I'm getting a little metaphysical here, but
I'm loving this.
I don't know. It's really cool. And I was just talking to someone about, you know, interweaving, you know, dreaming and psychedelics and like all these things that we don't really talk about that are probably mostly untouched by science or will be very hard for us to calculate and measure, but I think can have huge implications to psychedelic healing that most people aren't talking about. And I really appreciate what you were saying about talking about the shadow. Another thing that not a lot of people are talking about. And can we speed up that kind of life cycle that we're talking about of like, I think most people should go through some small phase of psychedelic narcissism and you know, the hippie phase and whatever, just to feel it, what it's like, so they have empathy and, you know, they can, you got to build up an ego to destroy it.
Absolutely.
But can we shorten that time period for people and make those, that life cycle, you know, shorter?
But also, you know, on a more macro level, like something else that there's a few things I feel like I really need to touch on before before we completely close the door on
please
the topic of the shadow side of psychedelics. But on a more macro level, also thinking about like psychedelic capitalism, like that's something that we're really going to have to be we're going to have to pay a lot of attention to and be very discerning with, you know, who we're talking to and their motives and things of that sort. So that's something else, like, you know, psychedelic capitalism, how that can attract some very shady individuals and how people at mass can be really harmed by these individuals, you know, negative or let's say harmful intentions. So there's, I mean, even individuals who are not shady, but who are naive, who have very good intentions, but what's good intentions going to do you if the outcome is destructive and devastating? Yeah. So, yeah. Something that I feel like I need to share, is that I've heard it more than once, actually. The first instance in which I've heard this was actually very tragic. It had to do with someone who had two experiences with MDMA-assisted psychotherapy in an underground setting. The first experience was very helpful. Someone was knocking at my door. But yeah, so that individual was saying that they were in remission from complex PTSD after the first experience. But also to say that someone's in remission from complex PTSD, that's a loaded statement. If someone was in remission from PTSD, that would make more sense. But complex PTSD brings us into, you know, talking about issues with development, and I'm digressing here. But anyway, so this person's first experience with MDMA-assisted psychotherapy in an underground setting was very healing. I really believed that when they told me that, but they were also a bit evangelical and a bit overzealous, which I recognized from my own experience. So I was, you know, I was happy that this person had had a very good experience, and I was a bit skeptical about the extent to which they were quote unquote healed or completely free of CPTSD, but I'm sure it was really helpful for them. And then a few months later, this person came back and was in a very, very bad state, because they had undergone the same treatment a second time. And it was like a flip of a switch. It was like going from having a very good experience that was very healing to being completely wrecked. It was a very, very, very tragic situation. This individual ended up taking their own life, and it was just really horrible. And it's just like, I mean, even people in the psychedelic space were really confused as to what was happening when it was happening. This person was seeking help from a lot of different professionals, neurologists, psychiatrists, but no one really knew what was happening. But yeah, so that was really tragic. And I spoke to a few of my colleagues who had told me that that wasn't an uncommon story, unfortunately. And I heard someone else say recently that they had two experiences with MDMA. First one was very healing. Second one was completely life-altering in a negative way. So, I mean, my opinion, honestly, is that I think what happens for these individuals is that too much comes up too soon or too quick. And I mentioned that I do work with integration. And from an integration perspective, if someone cannot integrate these, you know, this material that comes up, then they become fractured, or they become scattered. So yeah, so that's something that is really, these are really unfortunate situations, and, you know, part of the dark side, the shadow side, and we need to be more, you know, aware of it, and we need to talk about it too, because how are we going to learn? How are we going to prevent this from happening in the future? And also, you know, going back to the macro level, something that I think is very problematic is looking at people from a corporate, who come from a corporate world, let's say, from the corporate world, trying to market psychedelics as, you know, these healing tools. I mean, these healing panaceas, let's say. I mean, they're tools. They're very powerful tools, but, you know, a tool, you can think about it, it's like a surgical tool for the mind, or for the psyche, the soul. When you're working with surgical tools, you usually would trust a surgeon to work with it, right? It's the same thing with psychedelics, but it's more complex than that, because also, I mean, if people are educated properly, then psychedelics are quite democratic in the sense that it allows people with the proper education, let's say, with the proper preparation, it allows people to take their own healings and their own healing in their own hands. So you don't really need to go to a professional, but it's strongly, strongly and highly advised to, because then you get to skip out on a lot of trial and error and get to the good stuff, let's say. But yeah, but we have to be careful, because even these professionals really only know the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the science behind psychedelics.
Yeah, and we're still doing research on, you know, what is the interaction with schizophrenia or bipolar disorder? We don't really know. Most people say just avoid it, and the research is indicating that it's not good and it increases manic episodes.
Yeah.
But we don't really know, or with, you know, women in pregnancy or breastfeeding, we don't really know. It seems like, yeah, or, you know, we're still collecting data on interactions with prescription drugs.
Yeah.
We know certain things for sure, but, you know, they're making new prescription drugs every day. So yeah, there could be some interactions that we don't fully know yet, or yeah, certain disorders that we haven't even classified yet, or you know, that we don't know that interaction XYZ. So yeah, it is really interesting seeing. I'm equally excited about this was my dilemma that I was talking about. I'm equally excited about seeing the psychedelic industry growing so much and people getting interested in it. But at the same time, I'm as equally just terrified in a way of seeing so many people like either with bad intentions of just wanting doing it for the money, or with really good intentions, but just not a lot of professional training. And so they don't know what to do when someone, you know, has a quote unquote psychological break. And they think it's all, you know, good vibes. And, you know, I just give them mushrooms and play some nice music and it'll be all good. And then they, you know, someone strips off their clothes and runs up a tree and, you know, wants to run in traffic. And it's like, whoa, like
they're ascending.
Right. I didn't think that would happen. And maybe they run 100 ceremonies and the 100 ceremonies goes great. And then it's the 101 that they are just like, oh, like, you know, so it's unfortunate that there isn't there. Yeah. I'm seeing like certification programs pop up online of like, I'm getting emailed, like get your psychedelic training certification in a weekend. And it's like, no. So I think these,
it's only gonna cost you $10,000.
I think these conversations are really important to have, and in addition to, I want people to be excited and I also want people to be safe and to be taken care of and to take care of others. So thank you for bringing all these topics up. I think they're really important.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I'm glad, I'm happy to know that more people are talking about this stuff. I was just making a joke a little earlier about how, you know, someone is clearly having a difficult time and someone who, a facilitator who's spiritually bypassing will say, oh, that person is ascending. No, that person, scientifically speaking, is having a psychotic break and we need to treat it as such. Or, you know, spiritual emergency or that stuff. But yeah, I mean, from a transpersonal psychology perspective, yes, that's possible that the person might be having a spiritual, you know, emergency or emergence. But also when we see something that, if something looks like a psychotic break, let's treat it as such so that we don't run the risk of the person harming themselves even more. There's, or someone is having a hard time, you know, saying that it's not the medicine's fault, it's that individual's fault, you know, it's something dark in you or whatever. No, that's bullshit. I mean, it's not an excuse to demonize the medicine, but it's also not an excuse to place the blame on the individual. It's not helpful for anyone. So I think there seems to be a bit of something that I appreciate and I understand as someone who has, you know, had I've had the opportunity to really watch, join the psychedelic movement or the field at a time where things were just starting to bloom and blossom and change. I understand why people, and I myself was like this earlier, why as a response to the years of prohibition and the years of, you know, war on drug propaganda running the show, I can understand why people can be defensive, myself included. I was very defensive in the past because, you know, we're fighting really hard to undo the damage that dogma has created. But also we got to make sure that we're not causing more damage by trying to undo damage.
Where can people follow your work?
I have a few platforms that I use. So mainly the Arab Psychedelic Society would be a great way to you know, follow the work I'm doing or stay in touch with me. I also have another page called the Pragmatic Psychologist. So pragmatic.psychologist on Instagram. I used to post a lot on my personal account, which is now public. It's called Ayahuasca. but now it's actually kind of turned into a music page, to be very honest with you, because I've been moving more towards music recently. Yeah, I started playing with a band very, very recently. We just got signed by a record label. We're called Sira, actually. So
nice,
a lot of
congrats.
Psychedelic rock music. Thank you. Yeah, I feel like I could go on for another hour, honestly, talking about, you know, you mentioned a few things. I'll try to keep it short, though, because I'm sure we both have a lot to get to. But I'd love to continue this conversation at a later time, too. But yeah, I mean, talking about bipolar and psychedelics, I have a friend and a colleague. His name is Benjamin Mudge, who looks at, he's doing his PhD in psychiatry right now. Are you familiar with him?
I just heard of him. Yeah, okay. Last week.
So he treats bipolar, type 1 bipolar with ayahuasca, and is writing a PhD dissertation on it. So there's that. There was a study that was happening at UCSF in San Francisco, if I'm not mistaken. It was called Shrooming with Bipolar. I don't know what happened with that, to be honest. I haven't really kept up. But there's also exciting stuff. I was involved in some research looking at, you know, complex PTSD and MDMA, but looking more specifically at using MDMA to treat borderline personality disorder, which is it's a form of complex PTSD. So there is research that's happening there. There's two of my colleagues who are a lot more experienced and a lot more knowledgeable in the field. They're working on a paper, and hopefully it will be made public soon. It's Dan Roberts and Richard Zafeman. So I would really recommend everyone listening to this and who's interested in this topic, keep an eye out for that. Yeah. And in terms of psychosis and schizophrenia, I don't really know too much about it, but I'm not a clinical psychologist. I really need to preface that because, I mean, I'm very interested in clinical topics, and I speak a lot of the discourse I get involved in has is clinical in nature. But yeah, but I personally, I mean, from my own readings and my own training, I think that that a lot of psychosis and a lot of psychotic disorders and schizophrenia, they are very much rooted in trauma, childhood trauma specifically. So it would make sense if you treat childhood trauma, or if you treat trauma in general with psychedelics, it would make sense for psychotic symptoms to also subside or to be treated indirectly. So so much exciting stuff that's happening, and I really, you know, I'm holding on to the edge of my seat, as we say. So there's a lot more to discover.
Absolutely, yeah, and I'm excited to see drug policy and psychedelic medicine policy expand in the Arab world, and mm-hmm. the work that you do to have more collaborators take part. And I would love to see the younger generation get grants and able to do this mm-hmm. research and to expand this education in the Middle East, and to have people. Yeah, I would love to have to see more research transcribed into Arabic, and, you know, all mm-hmm. the amazing work that you're doing, and I can't wait to see the documentary when it comes out.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Alex, for this conversation, and for giving me the opportunity to talk about psychedelics in the Arab world, and, you know, to raise awareness about this. I'd love at a later time, I'd really love to connect and learn more about your involvement with music too.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that maybe not a podcast episode. Maybe I'll do a whole music and mushrooms episode. That might be interesting. But
I'm working on one of my colleagues. So I'm an assistant trainer with Fluence. I've done some training myself with them. I trained in psychedelic integration therapy with them. And I've also done some work teaching with them and training with them. But anyways, I have a colleague of mine, Sherry Taylor. She's I don't know if you've had the chance to see How to Change Your Mind on Netflix. So episode 3
is
about,
like, 3/4 of one episode. It's on my list to complete. Yeah,
I highly recommend the MDMA session episode. So Sherry Taylor is featured on the episode. She's doing amazing work with MDMA therapy for PTSD. But I had the privilege and, you know, the honor of actually meeting her at a Fluence training that I attended in New York in April. And her and I bonded over our shared interest in music. So we designed a syllabus on music and psychedelic therapy, And that's something we're hoping to create a course around in the future. But in the meantime, we haven't been talking about this so much recently, but this is a reminder for me to get back in touch with her. But what we did is we created a workshop on psychedelic therapy and music. So hopefully
nice.
We'll be able to
Amazing.
Provide that through Fluence. Yeah.
So that's super
definitely
cool.
If you ever have that that offshoot or that podcast, that spinoff, let's definitely talk.
Yeah, no, you definitely, like, I took a little break from playing music for a little while, and then I'm just starting to get back into it, and it's interesting. I've definitely used music as a therapy tool, and it's so amazing. It's just listening to music, but also dancing to music and then playing music. It's so therapeutic, and I think it's such a gateway to beautiful art, altered states as a way. It's just a creative tool to express and to connect to, like, unfathomable emotions or inexpressible. Mm-hmm. What's the word? Like, you can't communicate it with words.
Ineffable. I love that.
Ineffable.
Yeah.
Emotions that you. Yeah, you just can't express it with words, so you have to do it with music, or you have to do it with painting, or you have to do it with something else. Mm-hmm. And I love music so much. And
yeah, me too.
To collaborate with altered states, with the mushrooms or whatever it is, I think would be huge for so many people out there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, thank you so much. I'll keep you updated on that podcast, and then let me know who the woman in Dubai was,
yeah.
The mycologist, and I'll definitely reach out to her. But everyone, check out Haya's work, and excited to see all the different projects that you got going on in the future. Everyone, wherever you're tuning in from, thank you so much for tuning in and shrooming in for another episode. We love you so much, and please spread the word. We don't have a Patreon or anything that you could donate to for this podcast, but we do have a website, mushroomrevival.com. We have a bunch of functional mushroom goodies, from gummies to capsules and things like that. And you could use a coupon code PODTREAT for a surprise discount. I won't tell you how much you're going to get. And then if you don't want to pay anything, we're doing a giveaway, a special podcast giveaway. So if you're listening, this is the only way that you have access to it. And the link is going to be in the bio of the episode. So if you want to win some free goodies, enter there. And as always, much love, and may the spores be with you.